This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 1, Toxic Banks. Friday, August 14th, the announcement came forward. Alabama-based Colonial Bank collapsed, bringing the total number of U.S. bank failures so far this year to 77. With assets of $25 billion, Colonial is the sixth largest bank failure in American history, the biggest since Washington Mutual's banking operation was shut down by federal regulators and sold to J.P. Morgan Chase in September 2008. Colonial's collapse signals an ominous phase in the nation's banking crisis, stated the Wall Street Journal. Even as some large institutions show signs of stabilizing, a slew of regional lenders remain on the ropes, and regulators appear to be giving up hope that some of them can be saved. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to discuss the real collapse in American banking. The collapse that is propped up by U.S. taxpayers through the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the demise of Colonial Bank, as Patrick O'Connor describes it on August 17th, is, quote, another instance of reckless speculation combined with outright criminality. The institution had engaged in the aggressive lending focused on the real estate market in Florida. The subprime mortgage collapse, which particularly affected Florida, led to Colonial registering unsustainable losses and write-downs, and the bank lost immediately $600 million and then last month another $1 billion in non-performing assets out of total assets of $26 billion. Now, this particular bank had sought $500 million in immediate bailout money from TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and there was a condition that they raise an additional $300 million from private investors and other banks, but this was a total failure because a criminal investigation was launched into a deal with Florida-based mortgage company Taylor Bean & Whitaker, and agents with the FBI and Treasury Department smelling the racket raided Colonial's offices just earlier this month. So here's how the Wall Street Journal described it. Quote, the bank said the Justice Department is investigating its lending division that originates mortgages the bank does not intend to keep, as well as accounting irregularities over many years. Maya?
Ralph, what we saw then is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, the FDIC, oversaw the fire sale of Colonial to the North Carolina-based bank BB&T. BB&T is a bank holding company, a BHC, and it is among the 19 largest bank holding companies that were under the stress test by the federal government. Let's look at BB&T and this transaction. It involved what is now the standard for the FDIC of a no-loss guarantee, with the FDIC agreeing to share losses with BB&T on the $15 billion of Colonial's assets. This bank collapse alone is expected to cost the FDIC $2.8 billion, further depleting the deposit insurance fund, which last March was just $13 billion, that is, the assets that the FDIC still has. In addition to Colonial, four smaller banks also collapsed in mid-August. Community Bank of Nevada, Dwelling House, Union Bank, and Community Bank of Arizona. This cost the FDIC $875 million. Ralph?
Well, Maya, what becomes clear as we go over this, and it will emerge in the course of this program, brothers and sisters, the happy talk about an upsurge and a revival of banking is nothing more than a charade, because it's based upon the heroin injection of $23.7 trillion, which masks the inherent incapacity of these banks to sustain themselves, since it's always dependent upon toxic assets and speculative paper. about which there is no less an absence of collateral basis today than there was before. More institutions have already collapsed in 2009 than in any year since 1992, and the failure rate is accelerating, as the Wall Street Journal describes it. Of the 77 bank failures this year, 32 occurred in the last 7 weeks alone. What is this talk about recovery? The Wall Street Journal said that the banks are in far worse shape than those which collapsed during industry's last crisis from 1989 to 1995, and they're costing the FDIC enormously more. The federal agency listed 305 banks as problem banks, and Bloomberg News published last Friday that over 150 publicly traded U.S. lenders are overwhelmed by non-performing loans on their books that are equal to a minimum of 5% and in most instances larger percentages of their holdings. And that kind of level of non-performing loans or default paper threatens the bank's entire equity, since their speculation is rarely based on more than a very slender percentile of collateral asset. These institutions, and that doesn't include the 19 largest banks, have combined deposits of $193 billion, which is 15 times the size of the FDIC's insurance fund. Now consider what that means. The FDIC's deposit insurance, on which the massive American population relies, that is to say that they won't be confronted by the bank failure of the Great Depression in 1929, where their deposits, their holdings, their cash, their life savings disappeared in a flash. The FDIC was supposedly a guarantee against that. It is being overwhelmed by these toxic assets, and the process of bailing out these collapsing banks adds seriatim, Maya.
Ralph, we're discussing with Colonial and the smaller banks such as Community Bank of Nevada and Dwelling House and Union Bank. These are the small to mid-sized banks. And as you refer to, and I refer to, the 19 large bank holding companies, they're more than just banks, they're behemoth financial institutions. These are J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, which is now the largest since it added Merrill. It has assets of $2.5 trillion. Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, MetLife, PNC Financial Services, that is Pittsburgh National Corp, U.S. Bancorp, Bank of New York Mellon, GMAC, which was the General Motors Assistance Corporation, SunTrust, State Street of Boston, Capital One Financial Corp, BB&T, which bought Colonial, Regions Financial, American Express Fifth Third Corp, based in Cincinnati, and KeyCorp, based in Cleveland. These are the 19. Many of these started as regional banks and grew to national and international bank holding companies. These 19 have been propped up by the federal government. They control two-thirds of all the banking assets in the United States. Ralph.
Yes, Maya, and it's instructive to note, brothers and sisters, that the 19 banks, and this is 19 banks amongst multiple thousands of banks, of course, in the United States, that control this vast concentration of the speculative capital and assets that are deposited by institutions and individuals across this country. The 19 may be the major institutions, but of these 19, three are hegemonic. J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Bank of America, nearly $3 trillion in those three banks alone, and that's only the paper listings of assets. They are the hegemonic institutions, and what's instructive about that is that they're all banks that were in absolute terminal decay. Citigroup, Bank of America, failing. They had to be bailed out by these multi-trillions.
That's right, Ralph. At this moment, the United States government essentially owns one-third of Citigroup stock. It owns one-third of Citigroup, yet does not have a hand in the management. It is all done at arm's length.
Well, let's be clear about this, because the criminals, and that's all they are, such as Paulson, Greenspan, and Bernanke, and Timothy Geithner. These are the architects, the actual officialdoms at the Fed who presided over this orgy of speculative recklessness that makes Ponzi schemes look mild by comparison. These are the individuals who then were put in charge and remain in charge. They are, in fact, the appointment of Bush, and now, of course, they are the absolute masters of the entire economic and social policy of one Barack Obama. And more to the point, again, is the fact that these three institutions, which have been resurrected by virtue of multi-trillions of dollars handed over to them, they have not lent out this money. They have not made it available for consumers. They have not enabled those who are either losing their jobs or facing the loss of their support system through health care and pensions. They have not done anything for people facing foreclosure, the victims of the schemes through which they were suckered into low-interest loans that escalated enormously with their floating arms. None of that at all. Here is again the Wall Street Journal. Barack Obama's administration believes it has averted a full-scale collapse of the financial markets by placing multi-trillions of dollars in funds at the disposal of the banks. But none of the underlying problems have been addressed. Up to $2 trillion in bad debts and worthless securities, the so-called toxic assets, remain on these very banks' books, brothers and sisters.
Ralph, the Wall Street Journal has vastly underestimated the value of toxic assets. This was revealed in mid-August, August 11th, by the Congressional Oversight Panel. It's called the August Oversight Report, The Continued Risk of Troubled Assets. I suggest our listeners go to the internet and read this entire report. Ralph and I, over the coming weeks, will discuss many aspects of this report. It is that important. And while the Wall Street Journal talked about $2 trillion in bad debts and worthless securities, the toxic or troubled assets, which now in political doublespeak are called legacy loans, the Congressional Oversight Panel reveals that $10 trillion of assets are at risk from just these 19 behemoth bank holding companies. $10 trillion. To break it down, $657.5 billion is what they call level three assets. That is, assets that they value just from some econometric model where there may be one criterion of this model that they can actually measure. $132.9 billion in annualized loan losses, $264.6 billion in past due loans, something we're going to discuss in more detail, mortgages that are a month, 2 months, 3 months in arrears, but the bank doesn't yet want to foreclose because then it'll have a loan loss on its books, and $8.9 trillion in credit default sub-investment grade exposure. These are these toxic derivatives that the banks do not dare unload, because if they unload, it'll be at the market value of today rather than the value that they put on their books originally.
But they've been subsidized. They've been guaranteed. The government is underwriting any such losses that may arise from a current valuation of toxic assets. The structures unwound quickly, the report describes, for basic, simple reasons. The rates of default on subprime and other mortgages increased, real estate prices began to drop, and the rate of return in the value of these structured investments reflected false assumptions about risk. What does that say, brothers and sisters, in straightforward language? The books were cooked. The lies were inherent. The ripoff was intrinsic. Here's the language they use on page 15 in this report. The complexity of the structured vehicles surrounding securitization and the lack of distribution or disclosure of any information about the terms of underlying loans, coupled with uncertainty and lack of knowledge about future performance, made the challenges associated with any real asset valuation and liquidity quickly apparent. Everything was a Ponzi scheme. Nothing was disclosed. Everything was extrapolated from value bases that had no objective reality whatsoever. It is the fictive capital, as described, we've cited by Marx in the third volume of Capital and the 900-page masterful book by Hilferding in 1913 on finance capital, which lays out the process through which late capitalism, no longer able to engender the kinds of profits which had been always derived from the most extreme exploitation of labor, as labor organized itself, as labor was capable of fighting back, as the value of the assets arrogated to themselves by the masters of capital had to reflect their obligations, the social obligations imposed upon them, the rate of profit falls inherently, and they began increasingly to move away from all forms of productive activity. The question of the role of finance capital, this parasitic role of finance capital, is not a matter of a cabal. It is not a sector that has separated itself out from the workings of capital. It is the imposition of speculation and paper shuffling on the entire inherent structure of capitalism itself. General Motors recently crashed, was not making money from automobiles, not even in the process of attempting to do so. Their real funding bonanza was from GMAC. Liberals posing as radicals attempt to counterpose, brothers and sisters, so-called neoliberalism or free market capitalism to the reformist, more responsible capitalism, which is an entire myth. On the other hand, the attempt to counterpose a so-called parasitic financial sector to a more institutionally rooted capitalism is equally fallacious and equally romantic and equally without basis in reality. This report, in the terms in which it is framed, emerges as an extraordinary indictment of capitalism as a system. The economic assumptions about property values and default rates were increasingly inaccurate. Securities values dropped precipitously. No one can agree on what they are worth. Any price discovery mechanism for these assets is frozen because these investors and traders would not take the risk of purchasing them under any circumstances. And the defaults increased. The assets became, in the popular term, toxic. And it is increasingly difficult to turn the assets into actual cash. The more illiquid the market, the more attention began to turn to the risks they pose for the holders and the banks.
Ralph, you're quoting.
I'm quoting here because where would you find outside of capital language which so precisely describes the inherent and structural, historical, and institutional inability of capitalism as an economic order to advance productive forces or the interests of society at large?
Ralph, the Congressional Oversight Panel is specific. As you were mentioning, quote, "It is impossible to resolve the argument about whether banks are or are not solvent because of the uncertain value of their loans," end quote. Throughout this report, you see why the major banks are insolvent. They were not propped up by the U.S. government. And another warning from the Congressional Oversight Panel. Quote, "If the economy worsens, especially if unemployment remains elevated, or if commercial real estate market collapses, then defaults will rise and the troubled assets will continue to deteriorate in value. Banks will incur further losses on their troubled assets," end quote. This is an understatement because in the report, there is an entire section explaining how the commercial real estate market is collapsing. It also discusses unemployment and what that has meant for mortgages. For instance, on page 17, quote, "Of the total book of loans and leases at all banks totaling $7.7 trillion at the end of March 2009, 7.75% were showing signs of distress. A total of $596.75 billion dollars. The percentage of loans at least 90 days overdue or on which the bank has ceased accruing interest or has written off is also at its highest level since 1984, when the FDIC first began collecting such statistics. End quote.
Maya, you know, the description in this report of the actual banking process is quite remarkable. Defaults increase. Institutions with such obligations face a double-edged sword because the assets now move back onto their balance sheets from which they had been concealed. And these institutions wind up paying a premium price even though they are worth significantly less. A bank buys securities originated by other banks for trading or investment, but they are purchasing complex securities, and they don't know how to value these securities in their various asset accounts. A bank could have issued or held a credit default swap related to a particular complex security or held in a share in a pool of credit default swaps based upon an unstated underlying value of yet other complex securities. In either case, the decline in value of the complex securities underlying the speculation, the swap, and the pool of swaps flows then inexorably through to a balance sheet because the bank is called upon at some point to make good or to post additional collateral on swaps, and the value has been in rapid decline. This is a rather neutral but devastating account of the speculative basis of fictive capital, paper shuffling without any core value. They don't know how to value it. They merely invent the value. They print money. They print paper. They speculate upon the paper. They enrich themselves. And when the whole thing blows up, they then raid the treasury in vast amounts, more than the total value of everything produced by labor in the United States for more than a year and a half. That is the character of the crisis, and the document that we have been citing will be gone into in greater length and detail in future shows.
Ralph, meanwhile, let's look at the case study of another mid-sized bank that fell apart. The Miami Herald, July 13th. It took 25 years for Bank United Financial Corp. to blossom into Florida's largest homegrown financial institution, writes Martha Brannigan in the Miami Herald. But it took just one type of loan to sink its Coral Gables-based bank and trigger its May seizure by federal regulators, the Payment Option Adjustable Rate Mortgage, or Option ARM. This is a form of the adjustable rate mortgage developed by Marion and Herbert Sandler, who created the vast holding company in California, Golden West Financial. A look at how things went bad at the thrift, now revitalized with fresh capital and under new ownership, thanks to the FDIC, I should comment here, offers a window into the real estate and banking debacle that has punished Florida's economy. It's also a personal tale of greed and control, referring to the founder and biggest shareholder, Alfred Kamner, who was the chairman and chief executive until October 2008. The option arm, which was the basis for Golden West Financial in California, which led eventually to the collapse of that banking institution after the sale by the Sandlers, and also the failure of Bank United, gives the borrowers choices each month. Make a full payment of principal and interest, something in between, or a minimum payment that results in negative amortization. That means that the loan balance grows each month instead of shrinking because what you don't pay is added to the principal, and then, of course, the interest on this larger figure becomes larger each month. This goes on until the loan balance swells to 115% of the original amount, or when the time comes for the interest rate to reset, as it does with an adjustable rate mortgage. This becomes payment shock for the borrowers because their monthly installments skyrocket, often to double or triple the original amount, and they are unable to make the payments. Ralph?
Yes, Maya, well, this is endemic, and this is exactly the model through which the banking institutions at large have entered into terminal collapse. And the nature and magnitude of this is increasingly apparent to the most established of the newspapers and their reporters. On August 28th in the Washington Post, David Cho described it very precisely. The banks, too big to fail, have grown even bigger. Behemoths born of the bailout reduce consumer choice and tempt corporate moral hazard. And what David Cho is saying is that the very banks that had collapsed and were at the sickest center of the speculation and profiteering out of that speculation, who got out of their crisis through this subsidizing, through multi-trillions of dollars, they're even bigger and they're back at it again. Quote, when the credit crisis struck last year, federal regulators pumped untold billions of dollars into the nation's leading financial institutions because the banks were so big, officials feared their failure would ruin the entire financial system. Today, the biggest of those banks are even bigger, writes David Cho in the Washington Post. The crisis may be turning out well for the behemoths that dominate U.S. finance. A series of federally arranged mergers, underwriting of their losses, and guaranteeing of their toxic assets safely landed troubled banks on the decks of more stable firms. And it allowed the survivors in these banks to emerge from the turmoil with even greater strength of market position and even greater control over consumer lending and the potential to profit, writes David Cho in the Washington Post. David Cho continues, J.P. Morgan Chase, an amalgam of Wall Street's most storied institutions, now holds more than one of every $10 in deposit in the country, and so does Bank of America, scarred by its acquisition of Merrill Lynch, partly government-owned as a result of being subsidized through the crisis, as does Wells Fargo, the biggest West Coast bank. These three banks, government-rescued and owned, Citigroup included, issue one out of every two mortgages, two out of every three credit cards, and federal data shows. A year after the collapse of the financial system last September, the federal response has redefined how Americans get mortgages. But no consequence of the crisis alarms top regulators more than having the very banks that were already, quote, too big to fail, unquote, grow even larger and more interconnected, replicating the conditions which caused the collapse in the first place. Quote, it is at the top of the list of things that somehow needs to be fixed, said Sheila C. Bair, chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It fed the crisis, and it has gotten worse because of the crisis, quote unquote.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 1, Toxic Banks. Ralph, it's interesting that we have in the Washington Post quotes that you would expect from socialists, and yet these quotes are coming from bulwarks of capitalist reporting, such as Moody's. Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody'sEconomy.com, you'll be left with very large institutions and small ones that fill in the cracks, but it's difficult for the mid-tier institutions to thrive. The oligopoly has tightened, he added. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the Washington Post elaborates that very thesis. The worry is that the bailout skewed the financial industry exclusively in favor of the large and very powerful. Fresh data from the FDIC shows that the big banks have the ability to borrow more cheaply than their peers because creditors assume these large companies are not at risk of failing. The truth is the opposite of that. Consumers see fewer and fewer choices and higher prices for financial services. The mergers with the government's own making. The regulators push the failing mortgage lenders and Wall Street firms into the arms of the even bigger banks and then handed out multi-billions of dollars to ensure the deals. Their aim was to dull the shock caused by collapse and prevent confidence in the U.S. financial system from escalating and from the financial system itself from crumbling. Officials waived long-standing regulations to make these deals work. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, the article continues, and Wells Fargo were allowed to hold more than 10% of the nation's deposits despite ruling barring such practices. There has been a significant consolidation among the huge banks, and it is hollowing out the banking system, as you cited before, Maya, said Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody. We are left with huge institutions. It'll be very difficult for mid-tier institutions to survive. The oligopoly has indeed tightened, as he says.
And, Ralph, this has implication for consumers throughout the United States in reflection of consumer choice, not just the choice of where you bank, but what happens with oligopolies is the control of prices. In the last quarter of 2009, the top four banks raised their fees related to deposits by an average of 8%, according to research from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. In Santa Cruz, California, the choice of banking is rather limited. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase hold three-quarters of the deposit market. Each firm was given tens of billions of dollars in bailout funds, notes the Washington Post, to swallow other banks. Quote, Wells Fargo is really good at the way they cross-sell and get their tentacles around you, said Richard Hofstetter, president of Lighthouse Bank, whose only branch is in Santa Cruz. It's a small community bank. Quote, their customers have multiple areas of their financial life involved with Wells Fargo. If you have a checking account and an ATM and a credit card and a home equity line and automatic bill payments, to change that is a major undertaking, unquote. We have the major banks becoming larger and larger with the subsidies from the U.S. government. Ralph.
The McClatchy Washington Bureau report on August 21st addresses the claim that there is a rebound and a recovery in the works. The headline is, What Rebound? Foreclosures Rise as Jobs and Income Drop, by Kevin Hall. Delinquency and foreclosure rates on U.S. mortgages continue to rise in the second quarter, with loans to the most qualified borrowers going bust at an unnerving clip, especially in the hardest-hit states such as Florida and California. The numbers reported Thursday by the Mortgage Bankers Association show clearly that rising job losses are worsening the nation's housing troubles. The quarterly national delinquency survey showed that 1 in 10 homeowners with a mortgage are at least one payment late and thus delinquent, and another 4% have entered the foreclosure process on their loans, and this picture is increasing with every day. Nowhere is there less sunshine in this picture than Florida, the article continues. The survey found that from April to June, 12% of all Florida mortgages were in foreclosure. 23%, 1 in 4, are late on payments and under immediate threat of foreclosure. In California, nearly 11% of all mortgages are 90 days or more past due. The Golden State accounts for 13.3% of U.S. mortgages, and it is the site of almost 20% of foreclosure starts from April to June. The full ramifications of those foreclosures has not yet made its way or its impact felt. More troublesome and worrisome is the trend emerging deeper in the numbers. As the article states, subprime loans given to the weakest borrowers are now a declining portion of delinquency, while prime loans given to the highest qualified borrowers are in a rising share of delinquency. The rise in prime delinquency is a clear indication that the employment is the driver of mortgage performance. The worst performance coming in these areas combined job losses with large drops in home values. In other words, brothers and sisters, the assault on working people, the loss of employment, the closing of plants, the driving down of living wages, the destruction of the social support system of health care and pensions is making it impossible for working people to stay in their homes. Not only is it a question of the mafia-like loan rates that their credit cards entail, with Barack Obama opposing the meager limit of 32% interest, the impact on working people is having its own enormous rollover, escalator, multiplier effect on the economy at large. This crisis is only in its little beginning.
Ralph, to continue, because this McClatchy Washington Bureau article, What Rebound? Foreclosures Rises, Jobs and Income Drop, every single line is significant. August 24th, 2009. Prime fixed-rate loans are 65% of all U.S. mortgages outstanding. Prime fixed-rate loans, meaning the old-fashioned home mortgage. But more than 32% of foreclosures start from April to June. That is, almost a third of the foreclosures were with these prime fixed-rate mortgages, what are usually considered stable mortgages. They constitute 27% of all U.S. loans now in foreclosure. As Ralph was talking about people who are unemployed, the U.S. government effort, the Making Home Affordable effort, was geared towards borrowers who have jobs and income. But the increased rate of delinquency and foreclosure on prime fixed-rate loans reflects the massive job losses occurring nationwide. Workers losing jobs won't qualify for housing help. If you have a two-income family and one of those members loses their jobs, this family, this household, will not qualify for the Making Home Affordable effort because the total value of the monthly income has gone down. Quote, the reason people are defaulting on these loans is simply they don't have income, and there aren't any loan modification programs for someone who does not have income, said Rich Sarga, the vice president of the Irvine, California firm Realty Track, which specializes in foreclosure research. You've often heard us mention Realty Track because they monitor the home sales and the foreclosures. The rising levels of unemployment will probably continue over the next 12 months. He's optimistic if he just says 12 months. And it becomes the primary impetus for foreclosure activity. He continues, that's the wave that is just starting to hit, and we're just starting to see the problems now. If you look at the Labor Department figures, you can see what he's talking about. For the second consecutive week, there was a rise in the initial jobless claims, almost 600,000 claims last week, following almost 600,000 claims the week before, 576,000 and then 561,000. Ralph?
Reuters, August 11th, David Lauder, bad assets may need more support. The U.S. Treasury Department will have to consider expanding programs to cleanse troubled assets from bank balance sheets as current efforts fail to restart the markets. And as economic conditions worsen in the United States, the bailout watchdog panel stated on Tuesday. The Congressional Oversight Panel said in its latest monthly report, toxic loans and securities continue to pose a central threat to the financial system, particularly as smaller banks face mounting losses on commercial real estate loans. These banks need stress tests and capital support afforded to the larger institutions. The stress test for the largest 19 institutions must be repeated as the economy worsens beyond the worst-case assumptions. No one even knows the value of the toxic assets still on the books. This has to be repeated, brothers and sisters. No one even knows the value. Quote, no one has a good handle on how much is out there. Here we are 10 months into the crisis. We can't even tell you what the dollar value is. Some estimates are between $600 billion and $1.5 trillion in toxic assets spread across remaining balance sheets. the Treasury needs to either assure that a program is available for handling these yet outstanding toxic assets as they proceed to go into default, or consider some kind of strategy for restarting markets for the assets. The critical report comes down as the Treasury prepares to launch a scaled-down version of its toxic asset program. That is to say, brothers and sisters, more of the same. Quote, direct capital injection into the banks. The entire U.S. bailout program was aimed at buying up toxic assets that threatened to bring down the entire financial system. But due to the plan's complexity and with market confidence deteriorating, Henry Paulson, Treasury Secretary, shifted gears to use the money for direct capital injection into banks. And since then, his successor, Timothy Geithner, has announced plans to entice private investors to buy legacy securities and whole loans from banks. In short, they're gearing up to do it again, brothers and sisters, faced with an even more enormous and untrackable scale of default.
Ralph, that's an important point. What the Fed and the Treasury decided to do after the Congress allocated funds was, instead of buying up the toxic assets, which they said was going to stimulate a credit flow again, and now they call these toxic assets legacy securities, they gave the banks money, which, with other benefits that they provided, subsidized the purchase of failing banks and failing investment houses, such as Bear Stearns. Now, let's look at what we're going to face in the coming months. Bloomberg News on May 9th, 2009, quoted Deutsche Bank CEO Joseph Ackermann as saying, quote, "It's either the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning." To what was he referring? This was the commercial real estate bubble. He said, "A piece of the puzzle that must be calculated into any determination of the depth of our economic doldrums is the condition of commercial real estate. The shopping malls, hotels, and office buildings that tend to go along with real estate expansions. The residential investment went down 28.9% from 2006 to 2007. And at the same time as residential housing was declining, non-residential investment grew by 24.9%. Thus, commercial real estate served as a buffer against the declining housing market. In other words, the banks would have done even worse if the commercial market, which lags behind the housing market, if it had been declining. But what is happening now with the deterioration of the economy? That's putting it mildly. Commercial real estate, which lags behind the housing trend, is facing a crisis as commercial construction projects are losing their appeal. Not only are they losing their appeal, but as other Bloomberg articles show, July 29th, an article by David Levitt, U.S. properties worth $2.2 trillion, this is commercial real estate, are at default risk. He writes, about $2.2 trillion of U.S. commercial properties bought or refinanced since 2004 are now worth less than the original price, raising the threat of more foreclosures, according to Real Capital Analytics. Ralph?
Daily Finance, August 24th. Investors at risk as Wall Street repackages debt again. And the article states, in what may be a scary revelation, it appears that Wall Street is back to its old tricks in repackaging old mortgage debt into new investment vehicles. And for those who have forgotten the events of the last few years, the now infamous CDOs, or collateralized debt obligations, were a combination of risky mortgages squashed together in one instrument. And the article states, Wall Street can get a fix on how much these CDOs are really worth, but not easily. The investments are sitting there with a wide divergence between the prices sellers seek and the prices buyers are willing to pay. This is all about discovery. The problem is no one knows the value of these things. The only way to find out is somehow to put them back on a market. It's entirely possible that the market has been wrong. There's possibility that these pools will in fact get more trading unfolding. The risk is that something like this will explode the system on a greater scale than the last time round. And that theme is picked up again in Bloomberg Press by Lynn Thomason and Margaret Brennan on August 27th. Prediction: more than 300 further bank failures in America, financial analyst Meredith Whitney. The analyst who predicted Citigroup would cut its dividend last year, who said the number of U.S. bank failures would quadruple, has stated there will be over 300 additional bank closures in an interview with Bloomberg Television from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The small business owner continues to see liquidity come away. Unemployment has risen to the highest since the early 1980s. It's said to be 9%. It's closer to 20. Americans are falling behind mortgage payments at a record rate. Forced regulators see 77 lenders just in the most recent period. Colonial Bancorp closed by the FDIC, taken over by BB&T, the biggest failure since Washington Mutual and collapsed in 2008. And she states, the panic of the financial crisis may have passed, but the crisis itself is unfolding. Bloomberg projects that the difficulties and the problems with these banks will surge over ninefold this year. Many banks may be okay for a while, but the real driver for the economy, consumer spending, will never come back soon. Financial companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 index have collectively rallied 135 in the past 5 months and are already falling to lower levels not seen since 1992.
And Ralph, this brings us back to the issue of the commercial properties. The commercial mortgage-backed securities, which are included in those credit default swaps and all those mortgage conglomerations, are now becoming the key default instrument for these banks, because these are not $200,000, $500,000 loans. These are multi-million dollar loans that have been initiated by the banks. And as the Congressional Oversight Panel notes, bank troubles with the CMBS, that's commercial mortgage-backed securities, are two-pronged. The defaults are rising, suggesting eventual write-downs of the ownership stakes. And the new issuance market remains nearly completely silent. In other words, banks make money by giving loans, and they are not issuing new loans, these new large commercial loans. The CMBS, that's the commercial mortgage-backed securities, represent nearly a quarter, 25%, of an increasingly troubled overall CMBS market, whose now diminished value is still a substantial $750 billion. $750 billion where you're going to have troubles brewing. Because as Bloomberg notes, 2.2 trillion of the U.S. commercial properties bought or refinanced since 2004 are now worth less than their original price. Prices have fallen so far that $1.3 trillion of properties have either lost their owner's down payment or are close to it. Empty office space. Wholesale evacuation of shopping malls. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I think it's important that we understand that the magnitude of this crisis is not unnoted in the established media, as we've been attempting to show. But there's one other fundamental aspect of the concealed crisis that needs to be cited here. Paul Craig Roberts, who is a former cabinet minister for Ronald Reagan, has written an important article in Bloomberg called Spinning the Economic News and Concocting the Appearance of Recovery. Last Friday, a Bloomberg headline read, U.S. stocks gain, treasuries drop as unemployment rate declines, unquote. Let's look, says Paul Craig Roberts, at the reported decline in the rate of unemployment. Do you believe that the U.S. auto industry added 28,000 jobs in July amidst GM's bankruptcy, sell-off, and close-down of GM auto divisions and demise of GM suppliers? No. Well, that's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Obama government has officially reported. The 28,000 new jobs were created by, quote, seasonal adjustments, unquote. July is a month when jobs are automatically added by the BLS to seasonally smooth the layoffs of auto workers during retooling for the new model year. This year, the retooling did not occur, yet the annual seasonal adjustment ritual did. The adjustments, which never occurred, are made for supporting industries, which are idled while auto production had halted. More phantom jobs are created by the birth-death model. Payroll jobs data contain guesses about the numbers of new startup company hires and jobs. Failed businesses don't report lost jobs, and new jobs from startups are not captured in the reporting. The government estimates these numbers, but the estimates are based on growth periods, not on recessionary times. Consequently, during economic downturn, the estimates overstate the number of startup jobs and completely ignore job loss. The employment outlook was further improved by pushing another cadre of workers who have been unemployed for too long off the unemployment rolls. Remember, the term long-term discouraged, people out of work for more than a year, are not counted as being in the workforce. The length of the downturn means that short-term discouraged workers who are counted among the unemployed are moving rapidly into long-term category, which erases their existence and arbitrarily lowers the measured rate of unemployment. Now, this article goes into considerable length about how they spin the financial news, manufacture the appearance of recovery, lure people back into the stock and real estate markets where they can lose the remainder of their wealth.
Ralph, I think we should end with the lawsuit by Bloomberg News. This is a lawsuit to get the Federal Reserve to disclose the destination of about $2 trillion in bailout funds. The Fed has refused consistently to say where the money has gone, despite requests from Congress and despite requests from the press. A New York district judge ordered the Federal Reserve to disclose the destination of the $2 trillion in bailout funds after the Fed failed to convince Manhattan Chief U.S. District Judge Loretta Presker that the record should be exempt from the Federal Freedom of Information Act. She said that the central bank's argument failed. The central bank said that disclosure would harm borrowers' competitive positions. Ralph, to conclude.
Financial Times, Stephen Roach, the case against Bernanke. Ben Bernanke has been nominated by Barack Obama as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. The same Bernanke who, with Paulson, who come out of the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, oversaw the toxic crisis itself. And he writes, and I'll conclude with this, America's head central banker. It is important to remember that his pre-crisis actions were critical in setting the stage for the most wrenching recession since the 1930s. It is as if a doctor guilty of malpractice is given credit for inventing a cure. Maybe the patient needs a new doctor. And the article sums up what many articles have described and which we will comment upon in the next show, that the people who are in charge are the banksters, the thieves, the criminals who have created the crisis and are in rapid preparation of a crisis of even greater and major magnitude.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 1, Toxic Banks, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week. Tiki tiki no biniye, tazam tazam.